And now, Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. The story of life in Anawadi, a makeshift slum in the shadows of Mumbai's glittering airport and luxury hotels. Today, Sunil, a young rubbish scavenger, is finding it harder and harder to make an honest living from what others throw away at the airport.
Like most scavengers, Sunil knew how he appeared to the people who frequented the airport. Shoeless, unclean, pathetic. But by winter's end, he defended against this imagined contempt by developing a rangy, loose-hipped stride for exclusive use on Airport Road. It was the walk of a boy on his way to school, taking his time, eating air. It interested him that from Airport Road, only the smoke plumes of Annawadi's cooking fires could now be seen. The airport people had erected tall, gleaming aluminium fences on the side of the slum that most drivers passed before turning into the international terminal. Drivers approaching the terminal from the other direction would see only a concrete wall covered with sunshine yellow advertisements for Italianate floor tiles. The corporate slogan ran the wall's length. Beautiful forever, beautiful forever, beautiful forever. For waste pickers, the road where air cargo was loaded and unloaded was the most profitable part of the airport. Crammed with trucks, overflowing dumpsters and small food joints, the place was every week more overrun by scavengers. Some of the men flashed knives to keep Sunil out of promising dumpsters. Women from the Matang caste, traditional waste pickers, hurled stones. Worse for Sunil, big recycling concerns took most of the luxury hotel garbage, a fortune beyond counting, as fellow scavenger Abdul put it. At the end of Sunil's brutal days, he sold to Abdul what hadn't been stolen from him. While the Matangs averaged 40 rupees a day, his take was rarely more than 15, about 33 US cents. Sunil felt he would never grow unless he discovered scrounging places that other people hadn't thought of. He focused on a stand of yellow and black taxis next to the station where a food stall served the drivers. Sunil noticed that some of the taxi men tossed their cups and bottles over a low stone wall behind the food stand. On the other side of the wall, 70 feet down, was the Mithi River, actually a concrete sluice where the river had been redirected as the airport enlarged. By some trick of wind, trash tossed over the wall tended to blow back and settle on this sliver of concrete. It was a space on which a small boy could balance. Of course, if he stumbled, he'd be in the river. Some people pointed at him as he crouched there high above the water, and he liked the idea that the ledge work looked dramatic from a distance. He learned to concentrate only on the trash immediately in front of him, looking neither down nor ahead. For decades, the airport on which Annawadi livelihoods depended was a realm of duct tape, convulsing toilets and disorganization. Now, in the name of global competitiveness, the government had privatized the place. The new management consortium was charged with building a beautiful, hyper-efficient new terminal. A piece of architecture that might impress on travellers Mumbai's rising status as a global city. The new management was also deputised to raise Annawadi and 30 other squatter settlements that had sprouted on vacant airport land. Securing the airport perimeter was one reason to reclaim the land from the roughly 90,000 families squatting there. The value of the land was another. The third reason, in an airport branded the new gateway of India, was national pride. For among the things that breakneck globalization had changed about India was its sensitivity about its slums. Annawadians understood that their settlement was widely perceived as a blight and that their homes, like their work, were provisional. Still, they clung to this half acre. Abdul and Rahul lived in Tamil Sainagar, the oldest and most salubrious section, which was anchored by the public toilets. Sunil's stretch of Annawadi, poorer and cruder, had been built by Dalits from rural Maharashtra. The third side of Annawadi was a cratered road at the slum's entrance where many scavengers lived, sleeping on top of their garbage bags to prevent other scavengers from stealing them. Petty thieves slept on the rut road too. To Sunil, one road boy stood apart from the others, an antic 15-year-old named Kalu, who was the closest thing Abdul had to a friend. Kalu's speciality as a thief was airport recycling bins, which often contained aluminium scrap. Though the bins were in compounds secured by barbed wire fences, his tolerance for pain was a thing of legend. What Sunil loved about Kalu were his inspired enactments of movies he'd seen for the benefit of kids who'd never been to a theatre. With a high-pitched approximation of Bengali, Kalu would become the possessed woman in the Bollywood thriller Bhool Bhulaiya. With a guttural approximation of Chinese, he'd be Bruce Lee in Enter the Dragon. He refused to do King Kong anymore, despite popular requests. Becoming Deepika in Om Shanti Om pleased him more. "Are kya item hai," he'd say, sashaying. "Only she can pull off those old-style outfits." When other road boys gave him his nickname, Kalu, meaning black boy, they hadn't meant it as a compliment. But he had status, not just for the pain tolerance, but for his ability to manufacture fun. Sunil often eavesdropped on Kalu's conversations after dark, and in this way learned that policemen sometimes advise the road boys about nearby warehouses and construction sites where they might steal building materials. The cops then took a share of the proceeds. One midnight, Sunil overheard Kalu tell Abdul about a thieving expedition to a place called the Workshops. Kalu had gone at 11 p.m. and found some pieces of iron, but a security guard had come after him. Ditching the metal in high weeds, he'd run back home. "If I don't get the iron before morning, another boy will find it," Kalu told Abdul. "But I'm too tired to go back now." "So ask one of these boys to wake you later," Abdul suggested. "I could wake you," Sunil offered. The rats in his hut left him sleepless. "Good," said Kalu. "Come at 3 a.m. If you don't, I'll be finished." Sunil lay down on the maidan, a few feet from Abdul, and tracked the time by the movement of the moon. At his best guess of 3 a.m, he found Kalu curled up asleep in the back seat of an auto rickshaw. Rising, the 15-year-old wiped his lips and said, "Will you come?" Sunil was startled, then honored. "Are you afraid of water?" Kalu asked. "I can swim." Sunil followed Kalu out onto Airport Road, past a glittery departure sign and some security barricades that read "Happy Journey." The boys sprinted down a half-paved road. Soon, they were standing at the edge of a wide gully that took runoff from the Mithi River. Across the gully to his right were towering security fences protecting flood-lit hangars. Jets were rolling in for the night. The far left, where Kalu said they were going, was dim and still. He jumped into the fetid water and paddled towards some buildings. "They won't see," said Kalu. "It will be easy." Which was how it turned out. When Abdul woke at dawn, he bought the iron for 380 rupees and Sunil got a cut of one third. It was the first disposable income of his life. A few weeks later, Kalu asked for Sunil's help again. Sunil weighed this potential career path against the waste picking that led to maggots, boils, and orange eyes. But for now, he thought, he'd stick with his dumpsters and his ledge. He sometimes said of being a scavenger, "I don't like myself doing this work. It's like being an insult." He thought he might like himself even less, being a thief. Annawadians agreed that Manju was nicer than she had to be, given her looks, her mother Asha's political connections, and her punishing schedule. Mornings, she went to college. Afternoons, in the family hut, she ran the slum's only school. In the other hours, she provided cooking, cleaning, water collection, and laundry services to her household of five. Today's assignment for English literature was 18th century restoration drama and Congreve's The Way of the World. Manju hadn't read The Way of the World, nor did her professors expect her to. Except in the best colleges dominated by high-caste affluent students, Indian liberal arts education was taught by rote. She was simply required to memorize a summary. To Manju, the new importance of English was a byproduct of something she generally welcomed, a more globalized, meritocratic India. It didn't much matter whether a person learned the language by studying Congreve or by practicing Chase Manhattan Visa card dialogue at Personalities Spoken English. Competence in English was a potential springboard out of the slums. As she cleaned the two-burner stove, she repeated, "Themes are love affairs, social position and money." Roaches, 100 of them, scattered. Mirabel seeks social advantage through marriage to the beauty Millamant. Manju wanted to be a teacher when she finished college, and her great fear was that, in a fit of pique, her mother would wed her to a village boy who didn't think that a woman should work. In Congreve's drama, money's more important than love. This was her mother's position, obviously. Manju wasn't too interested in money. She hungered for virtue. Manju's instrument for demonstrating her decency was the school she ran out of her hut every afternoon. The school was financed by central government money, funneled through a Catholic charity, and Asha was the teacher, officially. But her mother was busy with her political party, so Manju had been running the class, displaying a commitment her mother found annoying. Although Asha was pleased with the small stipend the school brought to the household, she thought Manju should conduct the classes only on days when the supervisor came to check, the way a lot of the other hut school teachers did. The central government called schools like Manju's bridge schools. Her brief was to provide 2 hours of daily lessons to child labourers or girls kept home by household responsibilities. Sparking enthusiasm wasn't hard. As every slum dweller knew, there were 3 main ways out of poverty. Finding an entrepreneurial niche, as her neighbours had found in garbage. Politics and corruption, in which Asha placed her hopes. And education. Back in her hut, her students arranged themselves on the floor. "Good afternoon, students," she said in English. "Good afternoon, teacher," the children called back at deafening volume. Her students' singing rang out across the maidan, as it always did at this hour. Sunil, the young scavenger, liked to eavesdrop when he brought his goods to sell to Abdul. He'd sat in on Manju's classes for a few days in January, mastering the English Twinkle Star song before deciding that his time was better spent working for food. Abdul, who considered Manju the most everything girl in Annawadi, could only wonder at the small boy's sense of superiority. One of Abdul's arrogances was that he could predict the fates of other people, especially scavengers. Although contempt was a force that changed a person, being a waste picker hadn't yet infected Sunil's mind. If he still thought memorizing A is for apple might make some difference in his life.
Tomorrow, a feud between neighbours ends in tragedy, as Sudha Bhushar reads the next instalment of Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Justine Willett.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, this is Susan Ray, and our drama today is the first part of 6 of a tale by Wilkie Collins, the early master of the mystery and detective story. No Name was a novel about the stigma of illegitimacy, but it was rejected as immoral by the critics of its day, although now it's seen as a work of social insight, showing Collins at the height of his powers. Tonight, there is real-life detective work in the American cold crime case everyone's talking about. Serial at 9. Now then, the first of a 6-part adaptation of No Name by Wilkie Collins. A mysterious letter from New Orleans arrives to disturb the peace of the Vanstone family, who live in Coombe Raven House, Somerset. What is the secret that the parents of Magdalene and Nora Vanstone are keeping from them?
No Name by Wilkie Collins, dramatised by Ray Jenkins, with Sophie Thompson as Magdalene Vanstone and Jack May as Captain Ragg. Episode 1, March 1846, Combe Raven House in Somersetshire.
Nora, love.
Good morning.
Mwah. Magdalene was born with all the senses...
except a sense of order. Mm. Good morrow, Miss Garth. Mwah. I'm starving.
And what harm has the concert done for you? What form of suffering has last night's dissipation wrought?
Suffering? Don't know the word. I'm ready for another one tonight, a ball tomorrow, and a play the day after. I love pleasure.
Ah, beware. Men, some to business, some to...